Yet in this captious and intenable sieve, I still pour in the waters of my love, and lack not to lose still. Helena, All's Well That Ends Well. I've recently been thinking of the way All's Well Helena compares herself to kitchen implements, because sometimes when I look at you, my sternum smarts with an unromantic sledgehammer-like slam, or a pricking like the notching in of nails. If these sensations were not palpable, I'd pick lighter metaphors than tools. But carpentry's the best comparison. Sometimes affection hits us like a pan. And always, it seems, life's a colander. I've repeated this poem's epigraph in dozens of auditions as I kneel and pray in this same way and saying this, and every time a genuine emotion pours through the little holes and O's and E's, the sieve of Shakespeare never filling too. For, in the end, I ride the gyroscope of this crazy stage-dependent life because I have a surfeit of myself and must dispense with all of it somehow. This excess abundance is the reigning star of all I do, my too-much way of writing, the bodily requirement that I make more than one person from my single form, and the atomic way my rib bomb detonates.
Hello and welcome to The State of Shakespeare, the podcast where we talk with today's working Shakespeare actors and actresses and get to the really important points for actors working with the text. I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott. Today on The State, we have Ellen Adair.
Ellen Adair is a talented young leading lady who has appeared at the Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey, the Folger Shakespeare Theater, the Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival, and the American Shakespeare Center, just to name a few. Ellen is a splendid, fresh-faced beauty who combines girlish modesty with passion, verve, and nuance, according to a recent review of the New York Times.
Nice.
And a self-proclaimed Shakespeare nerd. She can be seen in What the Public Wants, currently on stage at the Mint Theater here in New York City. What you heard at the top was a poem that Ellen wrote, inspired by the piece she wants to talk about, Helena's speech from Act 1, Scene 3 in All's Well That Ends Well.
One of the three Shakespearean titles that repeat a word. Garrett, can you guess the other two?
Well, I can think of one. It's Measure for Measure.
Right. The third one is a little wonky.
Wonky.
Mm-hmm.
Is the repeated word a small word? Is it a definite article?
Yes.
It is.
Indeed.
Could it be the tragedy of someone, the something of something?
Not quite.
No.
But close.
Really?
It's not a tragedy. It's actually a comedy.
The comedy of?
No.
I'm stumped. What is it?
Petruchio.
The Taming of the Shrew. Well played, sir.
Yes.
Well played.
There we are.
But we're not talking about The Taming of the Shrew today. We're talking about All's Well That Ends Well.
Garrett and I are delighted that you can be here. And our first question for you is, why Helena? What drew you to this piece?
This speech has been one of my favorite speeches for years and years and years. It has been my sort of favorite audition monologue for a long, long time. And now that I have played the role, I'm afraid I'm going to have to find something else.
So, Ellen, welcome. Tell us a little bit about your background and training.
I have a BA in English and theater from Boston University. So I don't actually have sort of conservatory training. I just took a couple of acting classes there. And I also studied at Shakespeare and Company in the Berkshires for a couple of summers, which was great. But that's about it for me and training. I sort of always thought I was going to have to go to grad school in order to have someone hire me, but so far I have not found that to be the case. Mm-hmm. And so being a woman and knowing that, as a matter of fact, like, these are the years when I'm most likely to get hired, it seems to me maybe not wise at this particular point in my life to go off to grad school for 3 years.
So, Garrett.
Jim.
Did you go to grad school?
I did. I went to UCLA. And did you go to graduate school?
Yes, I went to the University of Texas. And Ellen didn't.
And she's a working actor.
And here you are.
And here we are. And we're teachers. So we have a vested interest in this sort of training.
So Ellen, this is what I want to know. How do you get roles? Everybody thinks training is necessary, and you've had a little bit, but what's your secret?
For one thing, I think I'm really lucky. I'm just really amazingly lucky. I think about that all the time, that I feel like I'm some sort of statistical irregularity in terms of working at the wonderful places that I do and with the wonderful people that I do, who usually have a lot more training than I do. But I mean, I will say that being at Shakespeare and Company for 2 summers was hugely helpful. they teach Linklater there. So I went through the Linklater progression twice, and I also took voice and speech, just one semester of it at BU. But we went through the Linklater progression, so I've been through it three times. And so in terms of vocal training, at least, that's been immensely helpful to me.
So for all you listeners out there, that's Linklater and Luck. That's how she gets roles.
It's very alliterative.
Yes. And we'll be talking about that at some point. We will. In the State of Shakespeare.
In some future podcast, we will. So for those of us who, it's been a while since we've read the speech, or for those of us who aren't familiar with it, could you give us a little bit of a background? Could you set the scene for us, if you will?
This is Helena from All's Well That Ends Well in Act 1, Scene 3. She is talking to the Countess, who has sort of divined by help of other people and also by her own intuition that Helena is in love with her son and has finally sort of trapped her into confessing.
So without further ado, Ellen, we'd love it if you would read for us or perform for us these lines of Helena's.
Absolutely.
Then I confess, here on my knee, before high heaven and you, that before you and next unto high heaven, I love your son. My friends were poor, but honest. So's my love. Be not offended, for it hurts not him that he is loved of me. I follow him not by any token of presumptuous suit, nor would I have him, till I do deserve him. Yet never know how that desert should be. I know I love in vain strive against hope, yet in this captious and inteemable sieve I still pour in the waters of my love, and lack not to lose still. Thus Indian-like, religious in mine error, I adore the sun that looks upon his worshipper, but knows of him no more. My dearest madam, let not your hate encounter with my love, for loving where you do. But if yourself, whose aged honor cites a virtuous youth, did ever in so true a flame of liking wish chastely and love dearly that your Diane was both herself and love, oh, then give pity to her whose state is such that cannot choose, but lend and give where she is sure to lose. That seeks not to find that her search implies, but riddle-like lives sweetly where she dies.
Wow.
That's beautiful, Ellen. That's a virtuosic performance.
You took us on a really nice journey there.
There are a lot of teaching points in there as well.
Tons.
Monosyllables?
Yep.
Short lines. And, of course, we'll talk about all of those things. But first, what's Helena's objective?
What this speech needs to do to the Countess, which had never been something I'd been really thinking about before, is she needs to see something in Helena that makes her pause. Like, she thought she knew what this was about, that, like, oh, she's, like, she has a crush on my son, but that it's a lot more powerful than that, and actually that Helena is a lot more powerful maybe than the Countess even thought before, though the Countess is always full of praise for Helena, that there's a real courage that Helena needs to gain in the middle of the speech.
Where do you think that courage comes from?
It comes from this sort of religious devotion to Bertram, and that as soon as I sort of start talking about him and, like, ascribing this him to the son's power to him, that that's where I kind of get my courage.
Well, there are two meanings to the word son, right? It's used in two different ways.
Yep. Homonym, I believe.
Two words that are pronounced the same way, that are spelled differently.
And in this case, one's with a U.
And one's with an O.
Right. That's where she gets her power.
From both the sun and the sun.
Yeah. And in fact, I believe that the word S-O-N is at the end of a short line.
Well, Jim, what's a short line?
A short line is one that is less than 5 feet.
5 feet.
5 metrical feet.
I love your son.
Yes.
Yeah, there's just the 2 feet there.
Which line are we referring to?
I believe it's line number 4.
What does a short line do? Why should actors take note of them?
A helpful editor said to me that the pauses were after I love your son, like the empty feet, so that Helena can collect herself and collect her argument. And I just thought, no way. Shakespeare gave us those empty feet because it's hard to say. Even though the Countess knows it, it's still hard to say. It's hard to, like, make this revelation. So I'm a big fan of, you know, looking at verse in terms of finding when Shakespeare is suggesting, actually, that there's a big pause. And there's a lot of them in this play. There are a lot of 2 feet, 3 feet. I think actually only a couple of times is there a verse line that's only missing 1 foot. There's a couple of times when there's 6 also. I can't remember offhand. But this is sort of the big one. But Shakespeare's telling me to take that pause, so I'm going to take it.
Shakespeare says to do a lot of things in his verse.
Now, you used a specific line from this speech in your poem. Talk about it for a second.
I think it just might be my favorite sentence in the speech. A side note is that I said intenable before because that's the way I'd always learned it, but this particular version we had inteemable, that is, like, you can't team it. I think they both make sense, but that's why I said one time and one the other time. I guess it, as I talked about a little bit in my poem, I guess I just hugely identify with it, that for me there are so many things that I can just keep pouring and pouring and pouring my love into, and I never lose any of my love, and the thing never fills up. And I really feel that way about, as I said in my poem, I feel that way a lot about acting and about this speech. Like, no matter how many times I do this speech, I still get like little stars in my body when I do it. And I don't know how else to describe it. I hope that that's a universal human phenomenon of feeling little like silver things in your body when you're speaking Shakespeare, because that's one of my, I don't know, primary physical experiences in feeling somehow really connected to something when I'm doing a speech.
If having little stars in your body were a universal human phenomenon, I think we'd have a lot more Shakespeare fans.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we have two different pronunciations of one word. What difference does that make?
Oh, we could do an entire episode on that one.
Maybe we should.
Maybe we will. But there seems to be a beat change in this speech because of the mid-stop.
How do you navigate those changes in direction?
Sometimes, depending upon sort of the sense of things, I think I might actually take a little breath there. Mm-hmm. Or I might take a little pause without taking a breath. Or I might just... I wish I could remember exactly what my teachers at Shakespeare and Company said about how you can make a beat change without taking a pause, obviously. You just, like, change the rhythm or the pitch of your voice. And I think that that's usually the solution that I think I've found in this particular case. And I think that there are sort of two possible reasons for the shift in the middle of that line. Previously, the speech was living with simply thinking of Bertram and not thinking about my relationship to him. And so remembering that, I think, chastens me a little. And then also, I think, and this was something that was very helpful to me in the production, was sort of like catching the Countess's eye again. That is, I've sort of gone off on this reverie, and then I see her and I realize that I've in front of her, I've been going somewhere else, which is maybe embarrassing or maybe not, but certainly something that then needs to be addressed. I need to speak to the person who's here in the room. So I think actually probably that particular one, I feel like I've probably dealt with in terms of just tempo change, that I think, but knows of him no more. My dearest madam.
I've always been a really big fan of beat changes. I think they're the actor's meat and potatoes.
As I said, I love that short line. I love your son.
Well, it's just because you have a son.
True, but it's also because it's a monosyllabic line. Ellen, how do you deal with monosyllables?
I love the monosyllables of I know I love in vain. It's so actually simple. Very often, Helena is using sort of large, multisyllabic Latinate words, and I know I love in vain is this sort of encapsulation, I think, of her entire situation. I know I love in vain, that I feel like that's the essence. And I feel like Shakespeare giving me those monosyllables is so useful to sort of just slow it down there a little bit. the wonderful director Paul Barnes, who I did a show with at the Folger. I remember him giving me that at one point. I was like, oh yeah, I love monosyllables. I can't believe I almost missed that opportunity. I'm such a dork.
She's a dork, self-proclaimed. I think you said that in the intro.
I did indeed. That's where I got it from.
But now I think we need to talk about almost the opposite of the monosyllabic line, the long sentences that are in this speech.
There are some long sentences in this speech. In fact, this speech, which is how many lines long?
I don't know how many lines. Oh my God, you stumped me.
Well, we should have our research assistant check how many lines long That's this right. speech is, but it's actually only 4 sentences long.
Right, and with all that ground to cover, how do you keep the ball in the air, Ellen? What about all those pauses?
How do you sustain the thought over the course of 8 or 10 lines?
It breaks it down into exactly the sections that I always inherently felt the speech had, but never really thought about. I'm almost always trying to keep the ball of the thought in the air and not have it drop. And so I guess I just think about the thoughts as they come. You know, I usually think about just trying to drive to the end of the thought, and unless there's something like Shakespeare has given me multiple empty feet in this line suggesting that there's a huge pause, but I don't actually think that that's... There's pauses that drop the ball and there's pauses that don't. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm just always thinking about what the next thought is. And I feel like, you know, it's just... It's ridiculous to say that it's well-written, but it is. It's just that everything is just a clause that's clarifying on the last bit, and it's always topping itself, and it's always sort of evolving. I guess in terms of technically, I feel like a great way to keep the ball in the air is to try to drive through to the end of the verse lines. I guess it's that I always try to think through to the end of the thought, and I just breathe on the end of the verse line. Sometimes I take a huge big honkin' pause, like before the sun, that's at the beginning of a verse line when it's useful to me. But I'm always thinking through to the end of whatever the thought is. I think that's what's gonna keep the ball in the air.
Line endings. What is a line ending?
How does an actor use them?
Well, at Shakespeare and Company, they believe that one should breathe on the end of the line. And I, for the most part, believe that too. Every once in a while, I will realize that, like, you know, the sense of this line will be much better if I don't take a breath there, if I just do these 2 lines in 1 breath. Mm-hmm. The thought will, because that to me, that's the most important thing, is the tracking of the thought rather than like some sort of dogmatic adherence to one rule or the other. The most important thing is that it makes sense and that I get my point across. But I think that very often breathing at the end of the line helps that, and it helps land things in the right way. And also, I mean, the idea at Shakespeare and Company is that if you're always breathing, you're always going to be open to new impulses, so that the speech can be a little different every time that you do it, because you're always sort of having a new inspiration. That is, you're inspiring, you're breathing in, and so that the thought can come out of something new. So I guess that's what I mean. And I do think that if one takes a huge pause at the end of every line, it will obfuscate the thought slightly. I have been there where I was like, this is the best tool ever. And so, like, at the end of every line, I was picking out the next thing that I was saying, particularly. But, you know, I feel like there, if I have one rule, it's to vary all of your rules, always. All rules should be broken. But I think it's a wonderful way to keep something alive, because I think it's also the way that people do it. They'll pause to think of exactly what that word is.
Can you give us an example of how an actor used a line ending in a production that you saw?
We went to go see a production of the Scottish play, which I just never say. I've done the play twice, and so I just don't say that word ever. I understand we're in a recording studio. No, you're not going to get me. And the man playing Big Mac, Dan McCleary, really changed my life. I've seen since then similar things to his performance, but that one was this moment where I was like, oh my God, it can be like this. Because he was just so simple and so direct and so conversational that it actually made that play a tragedy, because it was like, hey, this guy is your next door neighbor. And like, this could happen to anybody. It's not like he came out like already like twiddling his mustache or something like that. But he was throughout the entire thing, just so simple and so direct. But I still remember he had this amazing line ending that like lit up the lightning rod of my spine, where he said, "I have no spur to prick the sides of my intent, but only vaulting ambition." And I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. Because it is. It's right on the end of the line. It's like exactly what Shakespeare intended. But he really like picked that word right out of the air. It was amazing.
That is the one play I've always wanted to direct. And I have a great idea for it.
The Scottish play?
Yeah.
What's your idea?
I can't tell you now.
You're not going
to give it away to everybody?
That's what the people are
paying for. Because millions of people are going to be listening to this podcast. And one of them will be a director that takes mine. No, I'm just kidding.
So you're just going to put that out there into the world that you've got a fantastic idea for the Scottish play, and you're not going to share it?
Mm-hmm.
What a tease.
I am.
You just lost the entire listening audience right there.
Well, you can always call me. I think my email or my phone number is on the website.
He's available, folks.
Yeah, so I think actually this leads us to one of our touchstone questions.
It does. Thank you, Jim. Touchstone questions are those questions that we ask every interviewee that we have in the studio. It's like a little mini Shakespeare poll. So, Ellen, are you a versist or a punctuationist?
Wait, Garrett. Can you describe those two for a second?
Versist versus punctuationist.
Yes.
Well, I'll try. The question is about verse versus punctuation. Are you a versist or are you a punctuationist? And the question really means, from what does the actor draw his clues about how to speak the speech? Is it from the rhythm of the poetry or from the logic of the thought? What's the most important way to communicate the idea, by playing the verse or by playing the sense? When a character's speech is written in verse, the lines are organized according to a certain pattern, which is easy to see when you are reading the text because it repeats over and over again. Shakespeare commonly wrote in iambic pentameter, which means that there are 10 syllables per line. 10 syllables, and then a new line begins. But there are two things happening simultaneously. When speaking the words, is the actor's most important obligation to follow the verse or to follow the sentence?
Are you a versist or a punctuationalist?
I think I'm a versist. I think they're both very relevant, both punctuation and verse. But I feel like I was originally trained in solely in punctuation. Like, you can breathe when there's some sort of a full stop. And so I don't believe that anymore, I guess. That for me, what that comes down to is mostly breathing. And actually, I find very often it's useful to breathe as many times as you want to breathe. So long as it's not like a pause, so long as it's a breath, not a pause. There being a big difference between a breath and a pause. And sometimes I think, you know, there can be a pause without a breath, which I've certainly in the middle of a line when I feel like actually it's important that I somehow string this line together, even though I feel like for sense I need to take a sort of a pause in the middle.
Oh, and since we're on our touchstone questions, which of the two major tools do you think is more important in the long run, body or voice?
I guess I don't think of them as separate entities.
Of course not.
Now, if you had to choose just one, which would it be?
Oh, well, then I guess I'd say probably voice.
Why?
Just in terms of training, because I feel like in terms of sort of, at least personally, I danced for years and years until my feet gave out on me, but I don't have a lot of actor movement training. But because I live in the world as a human being, I think that what we do with our bodies every day is more analogous to what we're going to do with our bodies on stage in a Shakespearean play than what we do with our voices every day to what we're going to need to do on stage with our voices.
Right.
So, I mean, I sort of think life provides you with better training for your body, maybe. But then I've never taken any Alexander or anything like that. And so maybe people who are devotees of that could scream at me. But I wouldn't know because I don't know what I'm missing.
So finally, Ellen, a question that we have to ask. How do you learn all those words?
Tell us about your process. I mean, do you sit and read the play or do you do it by rote over and over? How do you learn?
I just start, not necessarily trying to memorize it, but I just start reading through it maybe, you know, 5 times a week, something like that, in preparation for going out there, because I want to be as familiar as I can be without necessarily having it memorized. Sometimes I find that it's a little memorized by the time I get there, and I don't really want to make choices without being in the production and without, you know, having seen the vision of the production and also having the director's input, because I think that makes me a little bit more inflexible. But I do want to try to have them under my belt as much as I possibly can. I'm a big fan of going to the gym. Actually, I'm a big fan of working on my script at the gym, because then I really If I'm reading through it while I'm on an elliptical machine or something like that, I'm really getting the words into my body instead of just into my head. I find looking at something when I'm sitting down to be almost useless. I have to at least pace. But I learn things two or three times as quickly if I'm looking at them on some sort of cardio equipment, which I know is because I'm employing my kinesthetic learning abilities in addition to my visual and audio. So, but, you know, also because I sort of loathe the word memorize. And I really like this sort of second grade version, learn by heart, because that's how you have to know it. It's like, I don't want my brain to know it, actually. I just want, like, my limbs and my heart and my ribs to know it.
And that goes all the way back to her rib bomb detonating in her poem.
Nice, bringing it full circle.
That's right. Well, thank you, Ellen. That was fantastically interesting.
It was delightful to have you here in the studio, Ellen. Thanks for being a guest on The State of Shakespeare. I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Ellen.
See you next time. Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening.